The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Simon Sinek. Simon is the best-selling author of Start With Why, Leaders Eat Last, and his newest book, Together Is Better, A Little Book of Inspiration. He has some of the most watched TED Talks of all time, and he's an adjunct staff member of the RAND Corporation. He speaks around the globe and has worked with a number of Fortune 500 companies and governments, including senior leadership of the United States Army. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about your new book and some of your other work, but I had a moment yesterday that I would love to get your insight on. I was watching an improv workshop yesterday at Second City with a group of advanced students, and we had invited two behavioral scientists from the University of Chicago to watch. So three of the students were doing a basic gibberish exercise. So that's where one student has to translate the gibberish statement of the other two students into English. And it was really funny. And after the exercise, one of the academics asked the translator if she thought she had accurately translated the intent of the students who were speaking in gibberish. And she nodded and said, absolutely, it was easy to understand. The other two students both jumped in immediately and said the translator had gotten it completely wrong. She wasn't understanding what they were attempting to communicate in the least. And the professor started laughing and said that, indeed, all the data they have suggests that we human beings are constantly misreading other people, that we continually overestimate our ability to accurately perceive the intent and wants of others. And that seems like something you have talked about.
It's so true. You know, the number of times that we go into a discussion, a negotiation, a pitch, an interview, where we're saying the things that we want and we're saying our ambitions and desires, and the other person's nodding. And so we take that to believe that they want the same things as us.
Yeah.
But so often then we do business with somebody, we take a job, we hire somebody, whatever it is, and we very quickly find out, wait, that's not what we wanted. And then with a few extra questions, we realize we're not actually speaking the same language. And this was one of the challenges that I faced when I first set out with this idea of the why,
yeah,
which is I got tired of being in discussions with people about what comes first, vision or mission.
Right.
And the reason, the problem is that there's no standardized definition of what a vision is or what a mission is.
Mm-hmm.
And so we literally talk at cross purposes. Or we go into things thinking everything's great because we've said, oh, yes, we all agree that this is what we're doing, and yet you have different definitions for the same word. And so I asked the people who believe vision comes first, what is vision? And they said, well, it's why we do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the people who believe mission is preeminent. And they said, well, it's why we get out of bed in the morning.
Right.
And I talked to people who believe brand or positioning or whatever they thought was the number one thing.
Right.
And they all gave me the same definition. And so I said, good, let's call it the why, and now we can all agree.
Yeah.
And to your point, I don't think my work is particularly unique. I think it's thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. What is unique is I found a language that we can all agree on.
Right. And this can be a sobering thing, or it can be a positive thing, which is, I think, the way you go with it, because it really is. I mean, you know, if you stop and look at it, it's amazing that we're not all crashing into each other when we're driving on streets, right? That is a modern miracle. So there are some stereotypes and some other stuff that kind of works in terms of our wiring as people. But, you know, it's interesting to be on this planet I've turned 50 this year and to realize that it's absolutely true that we get it wrong and that we're not perceiving things well. But in the parlance of improvisation, you know, every obstacle is a gift. So I think, and this is the way I think you approach it, which is, all right, let's take this mistake and make something of it.
And instead of forcing people recognize my definition, which is usually what happens,
yeah.
which is we debate our definitions, I called it something completely different. So to your point, which is I saw it not as an opportunity to convince people, but rather an opportunity to embrace what they already saw as true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I do want to talk about Start With Why, but I also – you have this new book, Together Is Better, and it certainly speaks – it continues to speak on the themes you have discussed in your other work, but the book itself is completely different from your other published works.
Yeah, it's a complete departure,
yeah.
to say the least. I mean, the other books were like – like proper books.
Yes,
like,
they're real. Yeah, this is not. I mean, it's not that this isn't a proper book, but it looks different, it feels different, it smells different. I mean, can you explain that for people?
Sure. So, you know, I have what I think is a simple message in all of my work, and I try and delve into the reasons why, you know, why it's important to have a sense of purpose, cause, or belief, or why is it that some teams trust each other and cooperate so well and others don't. Like, I was fascinated by the underpinnings. But at the end of the day, there's a very simple message that underlies all of my work, mm-hmm. my books, my other writings, my speeches, anything, which is that we're social animals and that we need each other. And that when we think we can do everything alone, we don't go that far. And if we're willing to accept help when it's offered, ask for help when we need it, achieve, it's unbelievable how far we can go and how we can achieve our dreams, et cetera, et cetera. And so I took this very simple idea. And I shared it, what looks like a children's book. It's a fully illustrated little book. It's for adults. I just decided to make it look like a children's book
right.
because it's delightful.
Mm-hmm.
It's delightful. And it's a metaphor. It's all it is, which is I take three kids who are archetypes, and at various points in our lives or careers, we have been each one of these characters going through our jobs. And many of us dream of starting a business, or we dream of a different job or a different boss. And, you know, the way you talk to people, ask them, how do you like your job? They say, it's fine. You know, how's your day? Same old, same old. Like, not enough people say, I love what I do,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
And so what if we wanted to leave? What if we wanted to change our lot? And so these three kids go on an adventure to find a different playground. And they learn the hard way that they're only going to find what they're looking for if they help each other. And the same goes for us. The same goes for us. And so I wanted to just communicate that really simple, inspiring message.
Yeah, we were lucky enough last week to talk to the Dr. Reverend Sam Wells, who is at St. Martin in the Fields. And he was saying that the human condition had a central problem, which was mortality forever and ever. And as science advanced and that became less of the problem, he would identify the central problem of humanity to be isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that there's a core to what you talk about in terms of the need of people to not isolate themselves and to recognize how they can grow and excel by being members of practicing in a community.
Well, look, being human is a paradox, right?
Yep.
Every single day of our lives, we are faced with a paradox, which is we are all at every single moment, individuals and members of groups,
mm-hmm.
right? And people have this debate, like, should we take care of ourselves before we take care of others? Or do we have to take care of others so that they will take care of us, and that way that's how we take care of ourselves? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
It's not one or the other, it's both. And this is the paradox. Every day of our lives, we're faced with decisions. Do we prioritize our interests, or do we prioritize the interests of our team or our group or our community? And the answer is it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to, and it's about balance.
Right.
And when the balance tips is when problems show up. And if you look at too many of the companies today, the way they run, even the way politicians run for office,
mm-hmm.
we feel that it's out of balance. We can feel that they're prioritizing their interests, their careers, their priorities over ours. It's out of balance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the result is we don't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm saying is let's get it back into balance. We're a little too selfish as business, a little too selfish as leaders, a little too selfish as politicians, a little too selfish as a society, and we need to just kick it back into balance.
Yeah. And what you call a paradox is also truly a duality. And I think when there's an improv concept called follow the follower, it's an exercise and a concept, but basically it's a reminder that everyone plays a role in leadership. And you have a great quote from the book that states, visionaries need followers as much as followers need a vision.
Exactly right. you know, visionaries are the ones who can imagine a world different than ours, and it would exist if only they knew how to get there,
yeah,
right? And the followers are the ones who know how to go, know how to get there, are committed to helping building that world, but they just need someone with a compass to say that way,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we need each other. It's not the visionary is not more important than the followers, and the followers are not more important than the visionary. It is, as you said, it's a duality, it's a relationship, where both people contribute to advancing the greater good for as many people as possible, and we couldn't do it without each other.
Right, right. And I think your views on leadership are interesting because they also speak to that. And a quote from the book also is, leadership is hard work, and it's not the hard work of doing the job. It's the hard work of learning to let go. And that is such a powerful concept for leadership in terms of, you know, pushing others to do great work.
And if you think about it, nobody starts as a leader.
No.
Start as a doer.
Right.
We all started off as doers. And you work your way into a position of leadership. Whether you become a leader is a different question. And, you know, when we're doers, you only have to be good at doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you become a leader, you now are responsible for the people who do the job you used to do, but nobody really shows us how to do that. They gave us training on how to use the machine, but then when we're responsible for other people who use the machine, they just expect us to be good at that, right? Like, they never showed us how to work this new contraption.
Whole different muscle.
Different muscle. And so we really have to make this conversion where we recognize that we're no longer responsible for the job. We're now responsible for the people who are responsible for the job. And letting go of something that we actually know how to do well, that's got us promoted in the first place, and allowing others to screw it up and learn their lessons just as we screwed it up and learned our lessons,
mm-hmm,
for some people is overwhelming, especially when their whole lives they've measured their own value based on the results. And now have to learn to measure their value based on results that others are able to achieve. Like, how good is a parent? You know, mm-hmm, is a parent good because they went through the checklist and read the book at nighttime and fed them at the right time and gave them healthy food? Is that a good parent?
Mm-hmm.
Or is a parent a great parent because the kid grows up to achieve great things and the kid grows up to be a happy, productive member of society who is a great parent with their own children?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And
right.
The same goes for leadership, which is you can only really judge the quality of a leader by how successful the people on the team are.
What was your first gig? What was your first job? Like, was it in high school? Did you have like a crappy, you know, working in an office or at a store?
Like my prop, like,
yeah.
Like not in this current career, but like in my life?
Yeah.
I guess I would very, very long time ago, like before I had a driver's license kind of thing.
Right.
I worked at the local bakery in the town I grew up in, one day a week on weekends. I'd go work behind the counter and serve, you know, croissants to whoever came in and cakes. That was my first gig. But then in college, I washed dishes.
Yep. I was a dishwasher too. So, you know, for me, and I talked about this all the time, my first job was in a grocery store. And basically, I learned so much in terms of, this was my first thought was, this is utter chaos and it's barely being held together. That's hilarious to me. And then I got to work. But it was a sort of a fundamental sort of belief. And I didn't know that I was going to translate that into the career that I had. But it was a very easy realization for me to make. And I'm sort of curious your path with that when you started, you know, being inside jobs and looking at how people was the light bulb going off then?
Well, I remember being junior in, you know, and even in my career,
mm-hmm,
where, you know, I was lucky and unlucky. You know, I had some bosses. I mean, I remember just all of us, these junior kids with, you know, 8 months of experience in our lives, sitting around going, how the leaders just don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, this partner who's been there for 30 years, how he's an idiot and he just doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was qualified to assess that. No,
mm-hmm.
And now I'm that idiot.
You know? Right, right.
And I can only imagine what people, you know, who work alongside me, who have a few months experience, are saying of me. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm the idiot who doesn't get it. And I think one of the lessons I learned there was, they may or may not get it. What they're really poor at, communicating the context within which they're making decisions.
Yeah.
And so the lesson I learned was, which is, I'm going to tell you the context as much as I can for the decisions I'm making. So you may not agree with my decisions, but you won't say of me that I don't get it and that I'm clueless, because there is a context.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can help you understand that context, then you can help me come up with better decisions, as opposed to just following whatever order I give. And that was the problem, which is people gave orders without context, and we were supposed to know, you know, what our responsibilities were, where all we did was know our tasks.
Right.
But I also had some really good luck. I had some fantastic bosses growing up in my junior career. I had one boss, Peter Intomaggio, back in the day, mm-hmm. and he just believed in total accountability, mm-hmm. which if you screwed up, you said, I screwed up. And you didn't get in trouble. You were just expected to say that you screwed up, and then other people could help you fix it or watch you as you struggle to fix it. That happened plenty, too. But he just believed in accountability, and because nobody got yelled at or fired when they screwed up, it made for an environment in which we were very willing to admit our mistakes.
Yeah.
If you get fired for making mistakes or losing money, then why would you ever admit when you made a mistake, you know?
Totally. That's my boss at Second City, same thing. Andrew Alexander, nothing made him more angry than you not owning up to your failure.
Yeah.
He could give a shit about the failure. He was like, and so I would often be, that's, I think, why we work so well for so long together. It would be like, I screwed this up. It's, you know, and it was like, and he was the first one I would talk to, in part because it was like, that was the easiest conversation because he just needed to know. And then he could sort of go, okay, yeah, here's how I might clean up that mess. You know, go get him next time.
Exactly. And it didn't mean that he was happy with
me.
He'd be like, come on.
Right, you know? Right. But it wasn't, but there was no shame. It was not, you know, and it's like, and that's the thing we're all running from.
There was no fear.
Mm-hmm.
There was plenty of shame, but there was no fear.
Yeah, good point. You're right. And quite frankly, though, it's the fear of shame, I think, that makes us not own up to those conversations because we see that coming.
And I had some right royal screw-ups, and I was embarrassed that I screwed up. I felt awful that I let my boss down because I loved him. But at no point did I ever fear for my job.
Yeah, yeah. That's the only place you can. That's the only way you can be innovative. So when I first saw, and I think I became, I was introduced to you through the TED Talk around the idea of start with why, and a colleague of mine had turned me on to it. And my because I didn't know what you were talking about, and I had been sort of initially in improvisation, we talk about improvisation like it's groups of people getting together to create something out of nothing. That's when we sort of like boil it down. And we talk to beginning students about the thing they need to do when they're first improvising is they need to find the who, the what, and the where. And all of that, as I think about what you talked about, is because when they are basically creating something out of nothing, they are searching for the why. And in your book and in the TED Talk around Start With Why, I think you're talking to existing companies and companies that are really already have their who, what, and where. And you're saying you can't sustain success unless you can sustain your why. Am I getting that correct?
It goes both ways.
Yeah.
I would love it if companies could understand their why before they started.
Right.
But once you've started, then you might as well go back and try and get it, or if it's kind of fuzzy, to clarify it.
Yep.
So there's no, it absolutely can be foundational. It doesn't have to come later. I prefer it come sooner rather than later.
Sure. That's interesting. And one of the things that you say too, which I love this quote, which is most companies have no clue why their customers are their customers.
It's true.
That is frightening to hear.
I mean, it goes back to your point of self-awareness, right?
Yeah.
Which is when we don't really know why people like us, you know, or why people don't like us, or how we're perceived. And it's amazing how many times, if you have a trusted relationship where somebody says, dude, you're a bastard, you'd be like, what? What'd I do? You know?
Right.
Or we have fears that, you know, we screwed something, but like, no, they loved you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know all the time. Which is why feedback is so important. And companies, it's true, you know, they don't really know. There's a great there was a study that Microsoft did. They wanted to understand how college kids made decisions when they bought laptops, right? And so mm-hmm. they did a ton of interviews of what students' priorities are, what's most important to them when choosing a laptop. And they, you know, different people gave different answers. They talked about memory. They talk about speed. They talk about resolution of the screen. They talk about movies, whatever it was, games, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they configured all these different laptops with different priorities. One was the fastest. One was the biggest screen. One was, you know, and then they opened up the room with all these different laptop options to a bunch of students, and which one they all went to? The red one.
Wow.
And the point is, nobody said, I want a red one.
Right.
Nobody even thinks when they're thinking about a computer that they want it to look fashionable.
Yeah.
right? And at the end of the day, when presented with all of these options that they asked for, it was the fashionable one that they asked for. In other words, we as human beings don't even know why we make our own decisions.
Yeah, why should we expect that then company? Yeah, you're right. I mean,
how can a company have so much hubris that they know what we don't?
Yep.
And most importantly, because they're asking us.
Right.
You know, Henry Ford said famously, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. What good companies are able to do is understand the reasons behind the things we're saying rather than things we're saying. In other words, they observe behavior and they actually can discern how we're making decisions, but not by asking us. But most companies think that it's price, quality, service, or features, and they compete on price, quality, service, and features, and they don't actually understand the biology of how people make decisions. And that's one of the things that I attempted to communicate or explain, which is this importance of this thing called the why, which is really central to human decision making. It's not my opinion. It's not some highfalutin management theory. It's the biology of human decision making.
Okay, this is so funny because I'm going to do truth telling on our company, and both I think why we've been successful and what the challenge we have. So, as an art form, this sort of improvisation, we use improvisation to create our shows. So what we do is literally ask the audience what they want to see and then show that to them. That's the third act every night where we're like, okay, what's on your mind? What do you care about? What do you not care about? And we're going to then so it's like, oh, genius. That's why for 60 years we've produced, you know, everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey and Steve Carell and John Belushi, you know, just scads. But us as a business, we always have these incredible we had a professor come in one time and he's like talking to us about how do you guys perceive yourself with regard to you as a theater and go, well, we feel like we're like a blue collar theater. And he's like, you guys are in Lincoln Park. This is one of the most expensive zip codes in the entire world. No one is walking in with, you know, a lunch pail. And we realized, oh, my God, we've been buying this mythology around the way the people who started Second City saw it. But even they weren't that. They were all from the University of Chicago. So we'd created a false pretext around all of it, which probably, you know, could have been the downfall if the core product hadn't been so audience-centered.
I'm not so sure. I think you need to give yourself a little more credit.
Okay,
right?
Do that.
So because it's the perspective that you have and the purpose or cause that you pursue, which is what's important. I mean,
I guess that's
Monty
true.
Python guys.
Yeah.
Right? The Monty Python guys make very blue-collar work, and yet they all went to Oxford.
Yeah.
That's where they met. That's when they'd all started, right?
Mm-hmm.
Richard Branson grew up middle class. He didn't grow up poor.
Mm-hmm.
Went to, you know, and he's now a multi-billionaire that owns his own island.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, does he only represent the rich? No, he's still a champion for the common man.
Right, that's right? true.
Mm-hmm. And he's a billionaire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So whether, you know, and somebody who's poor doesn't necessarily represent the poor, and somebody who's rich doesn't necessarily represent the rich, you know, which is, it's what they actually stand for.
Yeah.
It's the cause that they pursue. You know, this is why you can have two different politicians, and it's actually based on the decisions they make and who they champion and the perspective that they have. So absolutely, Second City can absolutely represent the common man,
right?
If your product is relatable,
yeah,
and is and if you look at the people that have come through your stage, and have gone on, they are kind of very relatable and one of us. And by the way, they've all made tons of money.
And they have.
So you're less relatable.
Yeah, but Bill Murray, I mean, Bill Murray speaks for a lot of people, and it's not like he's speaking for just the wealthy. I mean, that's
exactly right.
The kind of, yeah, you're right. And it's funny because you also, one of the things you say in Start With Why is about average companies, and I think you say they give their people something to work on. And in contrast, the innovative organization gives people something to work towards. And I think
Correct.
That sort of aspiration aspect rooted in a sort of a practicality conversation with the audience, believability, authenticity. You know, everyone brands all want to be authentic, and it's like they want to buy authenticity rather than just sort of be authentic.
Oh, yeah. We conducted a study to ask people how they want us to proceed, how they want us to speak to them and talk to them because we're trying to be authentic. You do realize that is in violation of the actual definition of authenticity.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Like, the definition of authenticity is you be who you are regardless.
Right.
Can you imagine going to your friends and saying, hey, how do you want me to talk to you? How do you want me to dress like you so you'll like me more? And your friends are going to be like, what are you talking about? Like, I want you to like me, so how should I dress that you'll like hanging out with me? Like, dude, just be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't try and dress or act in a way that you think I will like you more. That makes me like you less.
Right.
Well, guess what companies do on a literally on a daily basis? They hire companies to help them be perceived as more authentic. That is hilarious.
God, yeah, people are making a lot of money over that false dichotomy.
Yes, it is. Yes, they are. And yeah, it's yeah. Anyway, we could have a whole show just on that.
We could. And a slight pivot, though, which I think is interesting, is some of the way you talk about customers and the way companies might want to talk about customers. And you actually wrote, I think it was in a blog piece, but I loved it, was don't trust companies who put customers first. It means that employees always come at least second.
Correct.
And that customers should never be the priority. People should be the priority.
Correct. Absolutely. So can you imagine working for a company that prioritizes somebody outside the company more than you? You show up every single day.
Right.
You offer your blood, sweat, and tears for 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
versus somebody who wafts into Best Buy, sees something on sale, is like, oh, I'll have one of those, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that person's more important to the company than you who's giving your blood, sweat, and tears. And at the end of the day, if the people inside the company don't love the company first, the people outside the company will never love the company.
Right.
Because who do you think develops the product, develops the marketing, talks to the customer, oversees customer service? It's not the CEO. It's the people on the front line.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a funny story. So I stayed at the Four Seasons in Las Vegas.
Yep.
It's a really nice hotel,
mm-hmm.
right? And the reason it's a really nice hotel is not because of the fancy beds, because anyone can buy a fancy bed. The reason it's a nice hotel is because of the people who work there. That when I'm walking through the halls, they say hello to me, and I get the feeling that they actually want to say hello to me,
mm-hmm.
not that they were told by management to make sure to say hello to me.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I can feel it.
Yeah.
So they have a coffee bar down in the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to buy a cup of coffee one afternoon, and there was a barista there named Noah. Noah is fantastic. He's wonderful. He's charming. I loved buying coffee. I mean, it was such a silly transaction. I've done thousands of times, and yet I had a more enjoyable experience just because of Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I gave him 100% tip. He was so funny and nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to him, do you like your job? And Noah says to me, without skipping a beat, he says, I love my job.
Hmm.
So I said, what is it that the Four Seasons is doing that would make you say to me, I love my job? And he says, without skipping a beat, throughout the day, multiple times, a manager will walk past me and ask me how I'm doing and if there's anything that they can do to help me. He says, not just my manager, any manager.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Then he says, I also work at Caesar's Palace. And there, the managers walk past me to make sure I'm doing everything right, or to check me if I'm doing something wrong.
Hmm.
Is when I go to Caesar's Palace, I keep my head down beneath the rail. I just want to get through the day, and I just want to get my paycheck. He says, when I come to work at Four Seasons, I feel I can be myself.
Hmm.
Same person, different leadership.
Yeah.
And so this is the problem in our modern leadership in the country, which is we keep talking about getting the right people on the bus. Make sure you get the right people on the bus. Like, no, it's not the people. It's the people leading. It's the people driving the bus.
Yeah.
It's the leaders.
Yeah.
This is the same guy, and yet the experience the customer will have at Caesar's Palace with the same person will be profoundly different, not because of Noah, but because of who's taking care of Noah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And whether Noah feels, as he says, Noah said, at Four Seasons, I feel like I can be myself, as opposed to I got to put myself in a little box so that I don't get yelled at.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's the leadership. It's always the leadership.
Well, you and one of your recent blog posts, because you were talking about Theresa May and Brexit,
mm-hmm.
and you wrote, weak are the leaders who promise to carry the people, carry the company, or carry a nation. And the reason is simple. It's a promise they can't keep. Now, I don't want to get – well, no, we can get as political as we want. I mean, isn't this the problem we're facing right now in America in this election in terms of this promise that is – in no relation to the actual leadership and the governance that we are looking for, that we need, that will make us great?
So, you know, no leader on the planet can say, I will take care of you.
Right.
Right? Because they can't. It is, as I said in the blog, it is a promise they cannot keep.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Leaders are the ones who say, I will give you what you need to take care of yourself. I will work on passing legislation so that you can own a home, so that you can get an education, so that you can buy a house, so you can do what you need to do to start a business. That's what I can do for my we can fix everything in this country that needs fixed if we work together. I'll do my part, you know, in a political office. I need you to do your part as a citizen. Mm-hmm. Kennedy summed it up. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, which is incredibly inspiring.
Yeah.
Because we want to be responsible for our own lot. This is one of the troubles with the way some charities are run, which is it's just donation, 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 donation. And what you find is it actually does the opposite effect. It actually doesn't help people. It hurts people when all we do is give, 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 and give, because they just stand with their hand out and say, you've stopped giving to me. Why have you stopped giving to me? As opposed to, how can I help you get back on your feet? How can I, what resources, what education, what support do you need? There may be financial assistance, but how can I give you the financial assistance to help you earn your own living? Because we all want to feel proud. We all feel good for the hard work that we do when we see the results of our effort.
Right.
You know, we all know what a spoiled kid looks like,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Spoiled kids where all they do is get, and they never learn the value of a dollar. Those kids are the worst.
Yep.
Right? Same thing, which is that politician that promises everything for you is raising an entire country of spoiled children.
Yeah.
Where all we do is demand, 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 complain, 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 and yet when we actually have to suffer a little bit, or we have to work together, we like put our, we you know, fold our arms and like, you know, huff, you know, pout.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you look at American politics today, if you ask me, and I'm just as embarrassed as everybody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is, I'm tired of now criticizing our politicians, as embarrassing as they all are.
Right.
I think we get the politicians we deserve.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that's
a
good point.
I think our politicians are a mirror of us. It's not that they're divisive. It's not that they're narcissistic. It's not that they're self-interested and care about their own personal ambitions. That's us. We're the narcissists.
Yeah.
We're the self-interested. Look at the way we run our businesses, right?
Yeah.
We're the self-involved. We're the selfish bastards. We're the divided ones. Look at our country.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that not until we take some accountability for our own actions, and the way we lead, and the way we supposedly run our companies, will we ever get the politicians that we actually need?
Yeah, amen. You're absolutely right. No, we were getting what we deserve. So this has been awesome. And one of the things that we ask every guest who comes on the podcast is, you know, we have this yes and philosophy, and I think you espouse it in your work too. And the idea there that to build on anything, you can't say no, and you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute to explore and heighten anything in your world, especially when you're creating things that are new. And I'm wondering if you look back into your life, you know, was there a yes and moment? Was there a moment where you would have normally said no, but instead you broke out of what that pattern was and said yes and, or the reverse? Is there a time where actually that no was the yes and?
I mean, if I go back to when I first discovered this thing called the why,
yeah,
I faced my first test, right? My why is to inspire people to do the things that inspire me. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's hilarious. My why is to inspire people to do the things that inspire them.
Them, yeah, that's fine. Well, you know.
That's my why, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Inspire people to do the things that inspire them. And that is what inspires me when I see people do that. And I faced a crossroads, which is once I discovered this little idea called the Golden Circle, I could have rights protected and copyrighted it and started a consultancy and made my millions being the only guy who knew how to do this, and I was the one,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And my little team of proprietary NDA people, right?
Yes, 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 yes.
And my yes and was, I said, okay, I discovered something that profoundly changed my life, and it restored my passion. It wasn't an academic or commercial exercise. It came from a point in my life where I was in a dark place and fell out of love with my work, and this saved me. And the yes and was, I have the responsibility to share it with as many people as possible.
Mm.
That I learned that fulfillment in our careers is a right and not a privilege. It's not for the lucky few who get to say out loud, I love my job. That should be the rule rather than the exception. And so my yes and was, I discovered this thing and I embraced it, and now I'm going to share it with as many people who will listen.
Yeah, the free marketplace of ideas. You know,
that's it.
And that's the thing. It trips up so many people when they feel the need to hold on to that thing, that character, that idea.
Oh, they slap a little TM on the end of it.
Yep. And then, you know, because no, and you're like, you're not, if all you're going to have is the one idea, don't worry about it anyway. because that's not enough to drive you through the rest of your life.
And you'll see, whenever I talk about the Y or the golden circle, there's no TM at the end because it belongs to everyone. It's not mine. It is. I might have articulated, I might have shared it, I might have found a way to communicate it, but it belongs to all of us, and I hope people take it, build it, and make it even better.
That's awesome. Simon Sinek, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks for helping me spread my ideas.
You got it. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.